I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In more than 6,000 hours of shows and an influential career that spanned more than 30 years, David Letterman's impact on the landscape of late night is unquestioned. Jason Zinnemann writes about comedy for the New York Times. He joins me to talk about his latest book, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. From the iconic top 10 list to stupid pet tricks, Letterman and the shows he did for NBC and CBS had a tremendous influence on a generation of comedians and on the form and fundamental aspirations of a talk show. This is an archive edition of Midday, so we can't take your calls, but we invite you to join us for the legacy of Letterman, coming up on Midday right after the news.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for our nightly top 10 list. The category tonight from the home office in Sioux City, Iowa. Here we go, the category. Signs your new job isn't working out. Here we go, number 10. You have a desk but no chair. Number 9, coworkers always punching you in the stomach. Right there, that would be a sign. Number 8, you see CBS chairman Larry Tisch having dinner with Conan O'Brien. Number 7, you get stung by a bee. Not really a sign your new job isn't working out, but just as upsetting.
Where'd that come from?
Number 6, you work for NASA and your title is executive in charge of space probe quality control. Number 5, after work you go nuts and throw firecrackers into a crowd of people. Number four, your company physical is scheduled with Dr. Kevorkian. And number 3. People start saying maybe they should have elected your wife Hillary president. Number 2, in your one-page performance report, the word sucks appears 12 times. And the number 1 sign your new job isn't working out, your office nickname, Deadwood. There you go.
David Letterman reading a top 10 list from his third night on the air on CBS back in 1993. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. We're going to talk about David Letterman. Letterman did his very first top 10 list in 1985. And it became his signature bit in a 30-plus year career that included more than 6,000 hours of shows. Some fun facts about David Letterman. He auditioned for the role of Ted Stryker in the comedy film Airplane. And Merv Griffin considered hiring him to host Wheel of Fortune before giving the job to Pat Sajak. David Letterman did relatively brief stints as a stand-up comedian, but since the time he was in college until he left CBS in the spring of 2015, Letterman spent almost all of his time holding forth as the host of television talk shows. My guest today contends that those programs changed forever the notion of what a talk show could be. Jason Zinnemann joins me on the line from New York. He writes a column about comedy for the New York Times. His latest book examines the influence of David Letterman on a generation of comedians and the landscape of late night. It's called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Jason, welcome to Midday.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to talk to you, and I thought this book was a terrific read, full of all sorts of really interesting insights and context. So I thought it's really a terrific thing, and I will admit I'm a fan of Letterman. and the Letterman Leno thing, I come down on the Letterman side. So I was interested in reading the book, and that's not to say that I don't think Mr. Leno is a gifted comedian, because I think he really is. But a couple of little interesting things. The top 10 list.
Yes.
You say that the Letterman staff figured out that the funniest line, or the funniest one of the 10, needs to be number 3. What's that right. All about?
Well, I think that evolved a little bit, but they did top 10 list so long that certain kind of common wisdoms hardened. And one of the quirks, and I think longtime viewers noticed this, is that number 1 wasn't necessarily the funniest. And so they had certain ideas. Like, for instance, the first five were on one page, were on one, and then they would split to the next five. So it was important to have, to start strong, to have something that was, you know, that leads into the next page that was funny. And then, for whatever reason, the writers thought that number three would sort of build momentum. And then it's sort of a quintessentially Letterman touch that, you know, the number one would not necessarily be the biggest laugh.
And, of course, this is kind of interesting. The one we just heard, the number three one, this is during the time of the Lewinsky scandal, impeachment scandal in President Clinton's term, saying it might be better if they elected your wife Hillary instead of you. Mm-hmm. Very prescient, perhaps. Tell us a little bit about your arrangement, if there was one, with Mr. Letterman. Is this an authorized biography? I mean, you did have access to him. You did talk to him. You also did enormous reporting of this. Took you 3 years to write the book, and you watched more than 2,000 hours of archival footage. But what was your deal, if there was one, with your subject?
That's a very Letterman-esque way of asking it. What's your deal? That's a expression he likes to say as well. But the it's not authorized, and the relationship with Letterman sort of evolved. You know, when I sold the book, I didn't know if he was going to talk to me. So I, you know, decided to kind of really report around him quite exhaustively. And that brought me to Indiana and L.A. and talked to all his writers. And you know, from early on, they were helpful. You know, they showed me, you know, they opened up some their archives and showed me some early episodes. And at no point did Letterman or his people discourage people from talking to me, which is probably the most important thing, because of course every time I would contact somebody who worked for the show, they would contact Letterman. And then after he left retired the show, and I was sort of in the home stretch of reporting, they agreed to the interview. They never said no. Of course I asked early on, but they never said, you know, definitively yes. So then when I sat down and talked to him, that of course, changed, you know, a lot of the kind of contours of the book, but they did make a point. You know, they were very, helpful and accessible, and they ended up, you know, he talked to me, but I do remember early on them making a point of saying, this is not authorized, which was fine by me because, you know, I sort of viewed it the way I view my journalism for New York Times, which is this isn't a book I'm collaborating with Letterman. This is me attacking this like a journalist or someone trying to capture an important piece of comedy history.
And as you got to know him and talk to him and meet him, you say that it changed the contours of the book. And I'm interested that that's the case because you write a lot about the quirky, vast difference between his onstage persona and his offstage persona. He was a pretty eccentric guy, is perhaps a pretty eccentric guy, not close to a lot of people, not accessible, particularly in his later years, even to his writers and stuff. I mean, how did you feel about him, having known as much as you knew about him by the time you met him? What did meeting him do to your notion of him?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's important to be a little humble and modest about how much you can. I talked to him. I had one long sit down with him. I think it was a 4-hour interview, and you can learn a lot by sitting down with someone. But you know, we shouldn't exaggerate how much I can learn about his private life from 4 hours of conversation. Now, 3 hours of talking to people who knew him at all stages of his life, I think I learned a lot more about what he was like. You know, he had long said that, you know, he was the happiest hour of his day was when he was shooting the show. So, you know, what I found was that he was very serious, thoughtful, sober. You know, he was, frankly, a great interview. He was very, you know, but not, you know, he wasn't on. Like he was on the show, so you know he didn't dodge any questions. So you know, but I would say there were a few moments in the interview, and I write about some of them in the book, that underlined what almost everyone who worked on the show would tell me about just his general kind of perfectionism, which would, you know, manifest itself in a kind of relentlessly self-critical, negative attitude about the show, which had a huge impact on people around him. And there was a few moments in the interview. I mean, anytime I would bring up, you know, events that happened in the show, he would always blame himself. You know, he was not somebody who, even Leno, who he had this long, you know, rivalry with, even NBC execs, which he spent years lashing, you know, he would blame himself on that. So, and sometimes some of that, self-critical streak, even in that for our interview, was so like flamboyantly over the top, that, it made me understand what people who worked for him were talking about a little more.
I mean, you write right in the introduction to the book that his defining quality is his critical eye for his own flaws. And I wonder, you know, as an artist, most of the time that's considered a really good thing. I mean, I think of, you know, Beethoven, you know, crossing out 87 versions of a piece before he finally decides that it's finished, or the poet, you know, constantly revising, or the actor constantly, you know, looking into new dimensions of a role. But I, reading about this self-critical nature of him sounds like in some ways it was debilitating as well.
I think it's both, actually. I agree. That there's at points of the show when it's debilitating or limiting, and sometimes you know, self-sabotaging. You know, the big example that I give in the book is sort of his Oscar hosting, which developed this reputation as being this catastrophe. And I sort of argue and demonstrate that you know, his Oscar hosting stint wasn't that bad. It wasn't that terribly received, actually. But he, in beating himself up over and over for months and years, did more than anyone else to cement the reputation that it was sort of singularly terrible. On the other hand, I think this self-critical streak is also key to his greatness. I think, for one thing, it you know, made him a really fascinating on-screen personality. I think audiences could see this sort of tortured element of him. And I think that, you know, talk show hosts before David Letterman were very cheery, you know, glib, smiling. I would say they were not terribly neurotic most of the time. And then you had this completely new kind of personality come around. And I think that's a big part of what distinguished him. It would almost be as if, imagine you in hour-long dramas, you had to only have protagonists who were likable and uncomplicated. It would be tedious.
Right.
It would be horrible, right? And if anything, we're at this period where we are more fascinated by antiheroes and people who are complex. Well, Letterman was, I would argue, a kind of anti-hero of the talk show. That he seemed like he had a dark side. If you paid close enough attention, he could be hostile, he could be grumpy, he could be cranky, and he could be, just even in the context of a single monologue joke, relentlessly self-critical. He would tell the joke, it would bomb, he would make fun of himself and make fun of himself, and it would seem to eat at him through the whole show. And watching that was fascinating.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Jason Zinnemann writes the On Comedy column for the New York Times. He's the author of Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. I'm going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll talk more about David Letterman's nearly four-decade career. You can join us and let us know whether you are a Letterman or a Leno or a Colbert or a Trevor Noah fan. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the show. My name is Dave, and I check this now with the CBS attorneys, and legally, I can continue to call myself Dave. So I... Yes, sir. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there was some discussion when I left my old job at NBC. There was talk that maybe they would sue me if this show was anything like the old show. And frankly, I never took it very seriously because, for one thing, I thought, well, the legal department at NBC has their hands all tied up defending that Dateline NBC show. So they're not... And I never took it seriously. And then this morning, I wake up, and next to me in bed is the head of a peacock. So I don't know.
Right, the Godfather and the rim shot and the whole thing. So, Jason Zinnemann, you make this point early on in the book, and you flesh out your thesis as the book proceeds, that Letterman's years at NBC, when he was doing Late Night, which aired after The Tonight Show, so it didn't go on until 12:30 in the morning, was actually his more fertile and influential and important contribution to the legacy of Late Night than the stuff he did at CBS. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, why is Letterman important, right? He's why are we still writing a book about him? Why are we talking about him? And there's many reasons. But I would say primarily is that he was this incredible innovator, and he did very adventurous things with the form of talk show, and he kind of mainstreamed a certain ironic attitude that has become pervasive. And if you look at those things, I think that it was in the 80s on his NBC show where he really became famous for that and pioneered these elements. And I really think if you look back and you look at Late Night, it looked and sounded completely different than anything else on television. And even within that period of 82 to 93, there were, which I argue in the book, there's sort of discrete periods in there where they're totally different aesthetics for that show. By the time he gets to CBS, he's still doing very good work and really funny work. And in some respects, his show is better. I mean, I think his response to September 11th, for instance, is one of his greatest shows. He's sort of earned a kind of gravitas by this point, and he's great at sort of extemporaneous conversation. But I would argue that his show became less distinct from everything else. And I also think, one thing I try to do in the book is sort of remind people of how that show was received in the 80s. Letterman back then wasn't talked about merely as a comedian or talk show host. He sort of transcended the form. Even though his ratings weren't as big as The Tonight Show, his cultural impact on the 80s was vast.
Let's just touch briefly, at least, about the controversy between Leno and Letterman. I mean, actually, Letterman gave Leno lots of breaks, having Leno appear on Letterman's show on NBC. Ultimately, what do you think it was about the folks at NBC who decided not to give The Tonight Show to Letterman when he, for so long, had seemed to be the heir apparent? He had guest hosted dozens of times, many times. I mean, what ultimately led them to throw their lot in with Jay Leno?
I think there's many reasons. I think Leno was much more politically savvy, and Letterman was considered more difficult. But at the end of the day, the biggest reason is that, Leno seemed like the more commercially safe choice. And I believe... at the end of the day, made a sort of bottom line decision as opposed to choosing the most artistically important or adventurous host, which is, no great shock. This is a big corporation. A lot of their decisions are more conservative than others. And there's a lot of noise about how this happened, a lot of soap opera. But if you want to just cut right through it, that, I think, is the main reason. And on those terms, they made the right move, because for Leno got better ratings than Letterman for most of of the time period. Now, I would argue that there's more important things than, you know, a half a ratings point or a ratings point. But if you're looking for the person who's going to get draw the biggest audience, the broadest group of demographics, then Leno made sense. But I mean, as you point out, you know, when we started this, you said you're a Letterman guy and a Leno guy. I think that is really a big part of the growth of late night, is that, you know, you had to choose, and I felt the same thing back then, that this the late night war between Leno and Letterman in many ways raised the profile of the late night talk show right at, around the time, just a little bit before Letterman started at CBS, HBO started Larry Sanders Show. And in a lot of ways, a lot of those, the Larry Sanders Show, which was a show about talk show, and it was in many ways kind of inspired by the late night war. And the press coverage of the late night war was a huge part of why Letterman became so, you know, kind of culturally important in the 90s.
Jason Zinnemann, his latest book is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Let's go to the phones. Ellen in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Jason Zinnemann.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Jason. So here, you actually just use these two words for these late night talk shows, influential and important. And I'm wondering about the influential part. Yes, it's important. And the question is, what's the influence? In other words, are we sort of trivializing these incredibly disturbing events that are happening by turning them into comedy, or are we making people aware of these terrible events and what's going on in the world by getting them to watch something that they think is funny?
Well, Jason, what do you think? I mean, you've got guys like Jon Stewart and now his successor, Trevor Noah, certainly using, you know, often very tragic events as fodder for comedy or for at least an exploration as to how political leaders are responding. What do you think?
I mean, I'm not entirely sure I know what she means, which events she's referring to. I mean, my answer is no. I don't think they're trivializing events. I think that this goes to a larger question, which what role does art have in our culture? Should art discuss tragedy, you know, terrorism, current events? These could, do artists have a role, or should we just let politicians and op-ed writers discuss this and let artists, and I do think that late night talk show hosts are artists and comedians, can they give us a perspective that these people in the political sphere don't have? And clearly they can. Look at after September 11th, there is no more, you know, serious grave event. I think Letterman's response to September 11th was more memorable, was as memorable as any. And I can tell you, as someone who lived in New York during that period, that Letterman going on air and describing his own confusion and his own the trauma of this was comforting and galvanizing. And I think he reflected the way a lot of people felt in a way that no politician did. That's not to diminish what any, you know, all Rudy Giuliani and all the rest of the politicians said, but I think comedians can play a great role. The same is true with satire and criticizing politicians. Now, I think you have, you know, some of the, you know, when the Daily Show came around, you had some of the sharpest political critique was going on in the world of comedy. Now, is it possible that there's a limit to what comedy can do in terms of, you know, making political change? For sure. And I think we've kind of gone so far in another direction that people can exaggerate what comedy can do. Can it sometimes trivialize very serious and grave events? Yes, I do think that is the case. But does late night in general do that? Does art in general do that when they approach subjects like this? No, I don't think so.
Well, thank you for your call, Ellen. While we're talking about it, let's listen to David Letterman on the 17th of September, 2001. This is his first show after the September 11th attacks.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the Late Show. This is our first show on the air since New York and Washington were attacked. And I need to ask your patience and indulgence here, because I want to say a few things. And believe me, sadly, I'm not going to be saying anything new. And in the past week, others have said what I will be saying here tonight far more eloquently than I'm equipped to do. But if we are going to continue to do shows, I just need to hear myself talk for a couple of minutes. And so that's what I'm going to do here. It's terribly sad here in New York City. We've lost 5,000 fellow New Yorkers, and you can feel it. You can feel it. You can see it. It's terribly sad. Terribly, terribly sad. And watching all of this, I wasn't sure that I should be doing a television show, because for 20 years we've been in the city making fun of everything, making fun of the city, making fun of my hair, making fun of Paul, well. So to come to this circumstance that is so desperately sad, I don't trust my judgment in matters like this. But I'll tell you the reason that I am doing a show and the reason I am back to work is because of Mayor Giuliani. Very early on, after the attack, and how strange does it sound to invoke that phrase, after the attack, Mayor Giuliani encouraged us and here lately implored us to go back to our lives, go on living, continue trying to make New York City the place that it should be. And because of him, I'm here tonight. And I just want to say one other thing about Mayor Giuliani. As this began, and if you were like me, and in many respects, God, I hope you're not, but in this one small measure, if you're like me, and you're watching and you're confused and depressed and irritated and angry and full of grief, and you don't know how to behave, and you're not sure what to do, and you don't really, because we've never been through this before, all you had to do at any moment was watch the mayor. Watch how this guy behaved. Watch how this guy conducted himself. Watch what this guy did. Listen to what this guy said. Rudolph Giuliani is the personification of courage. And I have one more thing to say, and then thank God Regis is here, so we have something to make fun of. if you didn't believe it before, and it's easy to understand how you might have been skeptical on this point. If you didn't believe it before, you can absolutely believe it now. New York City is the greatest city in the world.
So I agree with you, Jason Zinnemann, that Letterman's off-the-cuff remarks in this incredibly difficult situation were quite profound and moving. And you make the point that he became the rare comedian who had the kind of gravitas, and he was sort of elevated as a public intellectual. And I wonder if other comedians have also started to enter that space. And I wonder what your reaction was, for example, to the news of this weekend when Bill Maher on his show on Friday night used the N-word. And now we have people calling for his dismissal. Not the first time folks have called for his dismissal from a show. As a matter of fact, after September 11th, he was booted off of ABC. Does a person like Bill Maher, Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, did they also rise to the level of public intellectual, or was Letterman kind of sui generis in that way?
Well, first of all, I think that I do think Letterman was different, and I'm hesitant about saying public intellectual. I think he had a an important public role. And I think, one thing that's really interesting is that when Letterman gave that monologue after September 11th, it was relatively unusual to do that kind of thing. Now, every time there's a terrorist attack or of a certain scale, late-night talk shows get very grave and sober, and they give a heartfelt speech. And I'm not criticizing that, but... it's become a part of the repertoire of why people watch these shows. And so I think, but at the same time, it's diminished the impact of each one a little bit. Part of the reason that the Letterman monologue had such a big impact is he was famous for being detached and ironic. And to hear how emotional he was, as we heard in this clip, you know, his the wavering voice and the dry lips, this kind of thing, it had a very big impact. To your question about Bill Maher, you're right. There's an example of somebody who lost his job because of something he said after September 11th. He clearly, crossed the line and made a misstep on the show this last weekend. And, I think the tricky thing is each person is different. Bill Maher is a little bit more known for, saying the things that you're thinking but aren't going to say. He tries to kind of approach the line. So I think he's always going to be risking something transgressive. And so that is a dangerous tightrope. It's both part of the reason why people watch the show, I think, and also one of the dangers. And Colbert, the same issue. I think increasingly these people are, public figures weighing in on politics, and that, carries a lot of benefits. People are, want, especially right now, there's a lot of interest in politics and Trump, et cetera. But they're also going to pay the price just like a politician would.
Jason Zinnemann is a comedy critic for The New York Times and the author of several books. His latest is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. We spoke last June. Since then, Letterman has signed a contract with Netflix to produce a new show. More on David Letterman when we come back after a break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, and we are very, very appreciative of that fact. If you are just joining us today, we're talking about the career and influence of David Letterman. My guest for the hour is Jason Zinnemann, the comedy critic for The New York Times and the author of a fascinating new biography of the enigmatic talk show host. It's called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. Follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Before we go to the phones, Jason, and take a couple of other calls, I want to ask you about your take on Letterman's influence in changing the sort of nature of the celebrity interviews that these talk shows have always, had as part and parcel. You say that he elevated the form from simply promoting whatever new movie or new thing they had coming out to something unpredictable and dramatic. How did he do that in ways that, Leno or the other talk show hosts do not?
Well, Letterman didn't like, he didn't particularly love talking to famous people, and he had a natural skepticism of show business. And his interviews with actors had a tension and a hostility even at times that just hadn't been on late night talk shows. The kind of chummy atmosphere and the self-promotion of The Tonight Show was mocked on late night. And I think for a lot of the viewers, myself included, as a kid watching the show in D.C. and suburban Maryland, I thought, finally, here's somebody expressing the way I feel about, these silly self-promotional conversations. And in so doing, I think he really Even though he wasn't, he was known as somebody who was not a great interviewer. I sort of argue that he was quite good, and because he was so distinctive. Now, he developed a reputation in Hollywood as somebody who, you know, you watch out if you go on his show because he could be real tough to you. But I think that provided a lot of drama that would have otherwise been absent.
Jason Zinnemann, the book is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Let's go to the phones. Angela in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Oh, you're welcome. I was just reminiscing about one of Letterman's top tens, and the topic was 10 things that only Barry White can say and make sound sexy. And I believe that it was either number five or number three. And I don't know how he did it, but he got Barry White's voice. And the voice of Barry White, he said, "Big ass ham." And I mean, my ex-husband and I, we that's like our inside joke. We just throw that out every so often, you know, "big ass ham." And it's just hilarious. I mean, I don't know how he thought of these things, but, you know, he definitely gave us something to. This was 20 years ago, at least 20 years ago, and we still throw that out. It's the inside joke, so I just wanted to bring that up.
That's fantastic. Of course, it'd be hard to come up with anything that Barry White couldn't make sound sexy. You know, top 10 is, you know, sort of just, you know, skimming the surface. Thanks for the call, Angela. I appreciate it. Carol in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Jason Zinnemann.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. A few comments ago, you were talking about the value of comedy and information. And let's admit, comedy is an art. And a long time ago, Solzhenitsyn gave this statement. He said, "Falsehood can hold out against much in this world, but not against art." And I think that's important for Letterman and for other people who bring us truth. Mm-hmm.
And Jason Zinnemann, thanks for the call, Carol. I appreciate it. The innovation that you credit the Letterman shows with, both the NBC and the CBS versions of it, extended past just his own brilliance. I mean, you talk about, for example, the director, Hal Gurney, and the way he shot the show. They had as many as 13 cameras, and I guess that was unprecedented and unusual. I mean, how did they make the look of the Letterman shows different than shows that had preceded it?
Many different ways. I mean, famously, they had the sky cam, which they put a camera up on high. They had a monkey cam. They attached a camera to a monkey. They were constantly trying to show you a different perspective from the traditional sort of theatrical talk show. So, you know, showing you backstage, showing you – there was one show that was the first 10 minutes were from the perspective of the guy in the back row. There was another show where you saw the perspective of Letterman. So when the monologue, you see the audience, you don't see Letterman. There was another great show where the camera rotated 360 degrees over the course of the hour. So halfway through, the image was upside down. So these were all really, you know, radical changes and disorienting, and not traditionally a joke. Hal Gurney was directed Jack Parr's show, had a lot of experience in this, and was particularly open to experimentation. He was probably his most famous tool is he did this thing they called a cutaway shot, where you'd be in the middle of a conversation Letterman would be having, say, with Madonna, and in the middle of the conversation Madonna would say something outrageous, and he would just cut to a person in the audience listening. Now that got a laugh. And it seems like a minor thing, but it's actually quite an unusual thing to cut away from, one, the people talking to a person listening, and two, to cut away from, like, two of the most famous people in the world to some ordinary person. And it completely changes the dynamic of the rhythm of the show in a really interesting way. And I do think that the way Letterman Late Night looked was tremendously important, as important as the way it sounded.
And when Letterman sort of came on the scene, it was the early 80s, and SNL was the sort of paradigm for social commentary and hip coolness on television. And you say that eventually Letterman overtook SNL as the coolest place on TV. How did they accomplish that?
Well, I think it's a combination of late night catching hold and becoming popular among young people and people noticing that it was doing all these bizarre experiments. And SNL losing some buzz, you know, after the original lineup left, and they had sort of a series of years where they were finding their footing, some good years, some bad years. But it's an interesting couple years in the 80s when Late Night with David Letterman was getting the great reviews and was considered the sort of hip, ironic alternative, and SNL seems stodgier. And I try to compare the aesthetics of the two. And one thing that several people from Letterman said that Lorne Michaels said is that he said that, you know, with SNL, we have to commit to a sketch, where Letterman, his sense of humor, whether it's in a skit or in his telling a joke, he always was sort of half committed. He had sort of one foot in the joke and one foot making fun of himself telling the joke. And that became a sort of defining not only a style of humor, but I think, you know, a whole generation of young people watching us at the time imitated that style, that sort of half committed, detached point of view. So in the 80s, that really had an impact.
On the NBC show, he was hired there to do late night after doing a daytime talk show. And you report that Roger Ailes at one point considered producing that daytime show. That didn't come to fruition. But Letterman was like writing jokes for that sitcom called Good Times for a little while. And he got his ticket to stardom because of his opportunities to guest host The Tonight Show. And at that point, when he was starting, Carson had gone from doing, I guess, four nights a week to three nights a week. So he was taking a lot of time. He had like 15 weeks vacation or something like that.
Right.
So there were plenty of opportunities for him and other people to guest host the Tonight Show. But when he got this job at Late Night, there were all sorts of restrictions on that program that were imposed by The Tonight Show, which preceded him. He was not allowed to have a monologue. There was no big band. And he even had to have the guests approved by The Tonight Show. I mean, it seemed like he was really, he had a lot of distance to swim upstream when it came to putting his show together.
Right. I mean, I think I have a quote from Meryl Marco, who was his head writer and kind of longtime collaborator, who said that, you know, when she got those restrictions, she couldn't care because she didn't want to do any of that stuff. And I think there's an interesting question, you know, why did Letterman go against the grain so much? Why was his stuff so adventurous? And, you know, one school of thought is that he had to be because he couldn't do a big band. He, you know, he couldn't use the same guests that Tonight Show did. So it's sort of the old cliche that, you know, kind of the limitations are the greatest spur for creativity. I'm not sure that's entirely the explanation, but I think that was a part of it for sure. As a kid watching Late Night, and I know I'm not alone in this, it always felt like the antithesis to Tonight Show. It felt like, you know, even down to like where the desk was, you know, on the right side as opposed to the left side. But New York versus LA and the kind of guests they had were very different. And, you know, where the camera was very different. So it felt like almost you watch the Tonight Show and then here you would have the response or the younger kind of snarkier retort to The Tonight Show. And I think that helped carve out a niche for Letterman. It might have also hurt in terms of him getting The Tonight Show job when it was finally open.
I mean, in the milieu of the early 80s, you write about a book that came out in 1978 by a former ad guy named Jerry Mander called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. Right. And there was this notion, I mean, Marshall McLuhan and others, you know, this notion that television was this vast wasteland. I mean, do you think Letterman was trying to, you know, purposely raise the bar for imagination and intellectualism? I mean, there were people like Dick Cavett and some other people, you know, doing things that were, you know, I guess considered on a higher plane intellectually. But was that a conscious thing for Letterman?
No, I don't think he was wanting to raise the bar intellectually, but I do think that the context that Letterman came up in was critical to understanding his success. And in a lot of ways, it was a completely different world. So two of the main things that Letterman made fun of when he started out were, one, how New York was this crime-ridden hellhole, and two, that television was, of course, dreck. And appeal to the lowest common denominator. Now, both of those things aren't true. If anything, the cliche or the common wisdom is the opposite. That television is sort of this prestige form that's leading the culture, and New York has been cleaned up. But they were the premise of a huge amount of his early jokes, and I think the reason that a lot of early Letterman was about television and seemed so meta and seemed to be making fun of itself was that television itself had this really terrible reputation. It seemed like a good target. Today, those jokes wouldn't make sense the way they did back then. Television doesn't mean the same thing that it did back then. And so, you know, that book about the elimination of TV, I mean, it's fascinating to see that was not this fringe point of view. There was the sense that TV's rotting your brain, and that, you know, most things on TV are terrible, and it's not worth taking seriously. And, you know, that was the backdrop for a lot of the early comedy.
We just got about 30 seconds left. We have an email that says, one thing Letterman did was that he called his guests out when they deserve it. Watch the interview between David Letterman and Bill O'Reilly, and you'll see what I'm talking about. That comes from Darnell. Did Letterman raise the bar? And again, I'm sorry, we only got about 20 seconds now. Did, in fact, he raise the bar to holding political figures' feet to the fire and people who weren't, you know, just movie stars?
I don't think that's his great legacy. I think people like Jon Stewart deserve more credit for that. He definitely did have great interviews with Bill O'Reilly and Trump, for instance. There's a long history of Trump being on Letterman, but I don't think that was his bread and butter.
Well, Jason Zinnemann, I've enjoyed talking to you, and I really enjoyed reading the book. Thanks so much, and best of luck with it.
Thank you. It's been great to be on the show.
Jason Zinnemann writes the On Comedy column for The New York Times. He's also been a contributor to Vanity Fair and to Slate and to Guardian. He's the author of several books about the entertainment industry. His latest is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. And we'll have a link to it on our website, WIPR.org/midday. That's it for us today. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Tomorrow we'll bring you another edition of the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. Also joining us will be the award-winning reporter Alec McGillis. We'll talk about his recent piece for the New York Times Magazine about Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner, whose real estate company runs more than a dozen Baltimore area rental properties. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up right after the NPR News at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.